You're listening to In the Drink, hosted by me, Joe Campanelli. And when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at my restaurants Fausto and Lalu here in Brooklyn, New York. On today's episode, we have a very special guest, someone who I'm personally super excited about, someone who's inspired me quite a bit in my career. He actually hired me for my first restaurant job at Babbo as a sommelier. We have David Lynch on the show. David was the wine director of Babbo as well as the GM there. He co-authored the book Vino Italiano, and now he's the editorial director of SommSelect. David and I had so much to talk about that we actually broke it up into two different episodes. So here's the first part of my conversation with David Lynch. David, thank you so much for being on In the Drink.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here. And I like my orange microphone cover. Very handsome.
Inspired by Friuli.
Yes, indeed.
So David.
Nice. One of my favorites. Orange wines. Absolutely.
Really what you're known for.
Yes. It's been a calling card for a long time. Yeah. As you know.
So you're right now editorial director of SommSelect.
Correct.
Prior to that, you had a really illustrious career in the restaurant industry. Won James Beard for wine service and James Beard for your journalism as well. Wrote the really seminal Italian wine book, Vino Italiano. It's something I was telling you before, the book that I've purchased more than any other book in my life.
I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Tell us how you got started. How do you get into writing about wine?
Writing about wine and working in wine really was born out of my friendship with Joe Bastianich, who I went to college with. And when I graduated college a long time ago, I'm not going to put a date on it. I really wanted to be a writer. I was looking around for jobs at newspapers and magazines and that kind of thing. And I was a little naive about how that all worked. My first job out of college was selling advertising. It wasn't for a newspaper in the Boston area. So I got in touch with Lydia Bastianich, who was always very kind to me and very supportive, gave me some writing projects to do for her. She used to do these advertorial kind of things in the New York Times, these little, recipe sections. And so I wrote a couple of those with her. And it was my first opportunity to get some clips. I go back to the days where you cut stuff out of a paper or a magazine and stuck it in a little portfolio and carried it around and tried to show people your writing, or sent them copies of them if you were trying to get a job. So that was some of my first sort of getting into the food and wine thing. I ended up getting a job more on the editorial side for a pair of newspapers, actually, both of which covered the food industry. It was kind of like mini nations restaurant news on the East Coast and in the Northeast. So it's like New England food service industry. So we're talking not just maybe I went to a couple of my first wine dinners in that job, but I also had to go cover the school lunch world, or go visit a distributor and write something about a food distributor. It's here's our refrigerators, here's our trucks, there was a section of that paper that was kind of gossip about a lot of New England states. They don't have the food companies don't have direct representation. They have brokers that cover the markets for them. So it's so and so just picked up the. It was it's very much like ad week for there was a lot of comings and goings and people on the move and who got this line. They just picked up Kraft Singles. Oh my God, that's going to be big for them. That kind of stuff. So it was but I was doing everything. So it was really a one-man show, literally, editing, writing everything, paste up. I mean, this is going way back. This is to the days of X-Acto knives and little slanted tables where you pasted all that stuff.
That's how you'd lay together.
Lay out the paper.
Yeah. Wow.
And then I got a job in New York, which was my dream. I got a job at another trade publication that is still around, I believe. It's called Cheers. It's a bar and restaurant magazine. We used to do some beautiful full-on budget art director, the whole nine yards. It was pretty cool. And obviously when I came to New York, I still was in touch with Joe and started to get in touch with Josh Green at Wine and Spirits. And I would say my first sort of real wine writing job was at Wine and Spirits magazine. And those were the days of
your clips to Josh Green or how did
I did. Oh. I had to bring my clips to Josh Green. He's a very good writer, as you know. A very, very good editor, a very interesting thinker. I learned a tremendous amount from him. He's really one of the good guys in the wine business, and he's really trying to like do something thoughtful with everything he does, and like sort of tortures himself along the way to try to make that happen with every issue, is like this like birthing of a child in a real way. And I think it still is. I mean, I still am in touch with them. And, you know, Tara, who's been there forever, she was my colleague, Tara Thomas, who I love and respect a lot. And it was really a formative like tasting experience for me too, because we were doing the tasting panels there with a lot of great sommeliers, you know, a lot of the old school guys, Daniel Janis and Roger DeGorn, you know, some of the real sort of icons of New York wine. So
they
that
still
was great.
Put on, I still get invites to tasting panels.
Awesome. That's
They're
fantastic.
Great. They're great. I think any young sommelier can get on those. You get to taste
tons
of wine.
I would occasionally get invited to when I was out in San Francisco, I would try to go to some, but I just couldn't really ever get there. Plus it's like, hey, we're going to taste 40 California Merlots. I'm like, yeah, I'm good, you know, but out here was all the European wine. So it was great. And it was incredibly educational. I did at that time, the Kevin Zarelli class back then, you know, kind of
the windows on the world.
Yeah.
Class.
The windows on the world thing. And you know, up there,
wow.
I was a pourer. I had my little white lab coat and poured for it. Yeah. That was incredible. Cause I, you know, like sitting across from a guy like Daniel Janis and tasting, and I didn't say much. I mostly kept my mouth shut and just sort of voted yay or nay on whatever wine it was. And Josh is a very, very good taster too. Really, really precise, really, really thoughtful, really, you know. And I mean, I just like the way that he also approached tasting notes was, you know, as I used to edit them, you know, and just like, my God, how does he pull this out? Like, how does he get, like, how does he do this? You know, because it's just, they go deep on those tasting notes in that magazine, you know, and they're trying to kind of really give you a sense of what the wine is like. Like the score is like really to them kind of, I mean, you have to have them say what you want about scores, but it's kind of incidental to what's actually there. And I, you know, I always wondered, I was like, who are we doing this for? You know, but that was hugely formative, obviously. And I got to write some fun stuff. You know, my James Beard Award was actually for an article about tequila, not about wine. And I got to go down there and tour around down there. It was very cool. Remember the Herradura guy had a bulletproof car. Like there was, you know, there was worries about like, you know, I was down there with an importer named Robert Denton, who brought in a lot of like the early, like sort of boutique tequilas. And he was like my shepherd down there for that. Got to go to Scotland, you know, got to start doing my first travel around wine and spirits, which I think is hugely important. You know, I don't think I got to Europe until I was 30 years old, you know? So that's something that anyone who like asks me for advice, why they would, I don't know. But if they do, I would say just try to travel as much as you can. It's so invaluable. I mean, I only got to Burgundy for the first time last year, 2 years ago. You know, I've been obviously all over Italy now. I spent, you know, when Joe decided to do this book and, you know, we decided to do it together, I took a year off. We put all our stuff in storage, my wife and I. We had an apartment on the Lower East Side, which was a killer apartment. We subletted it. I still wish I could have bought that apartment, but because at the time it was on the Lower East Side, it was on Suffolk Street, super That's location awesome. Right
was
above
Enoteca
the
Enoteca around in those days?
Yes. Yeah. Towards the tail end of our tenure mm-hmm. there. So it was, I mean, I watched 71 Clinton be built when I was living there and was an early customer.
Wiley and Dewey.
Yeah. We had an argument over corked wine one night, Dewey and I.
I was
like, the wine's corked. He's like, no, it isn't. I was like, dude, come on, man. It's corked. You know, I don't want to be a dick, but, you know, it's corked. And so we packed up and we went over there and we lived there. And I'll tell you, the first couple of months were really tough because I was learning, you know, I'd studied the language a little bit, but I didn't become really fluid for a couple of months. You know, I had taken some classes. I'm pretty good with languages, but I mean, in terms of getting really functional, it takes a while. And now, you know, now I'm pretty fluent, but I stumble a lot, you know, vocabulary especially. But and we just started out, and we started out in Friuli. Naturally, we had some connections there with Joe. Joe had just sort of started with the wine stuff over there, making wine in Friuli. But we also had a guy named Walter Scarbolo, who's a lot of people know now. He's along with Alex Kristancic of Movia, has become kind of a known guy over here. Martin Foradori of Hofstetter. Paolo Domenighetti from Domain Select Wine and Spirits was a big helper to me on organizing a lot of that trip, put me in touch with a lot of people. But that trip was well organized for like the first 2 months, and then it was just chaos and it was intense. Like we bought a car through Walter's winery. It was a Fiat Chroma. It was a very you probably know what a Fiat Chroma looks like. It's not like anything sexy. It's like the Ford Taurus of Fiats, basically. And it was an oil guzzling, gas guzzling, terrible car. It was a terrible car. Like, it, you know, we had some issues with it. Plus, it was like loaded down with wine. Of course, everything was paper. There was like very little, I think at that time it was like dial-up modem, very sketchy, especially when you're in like Basilicata or Apulia and some random place.
You're putting kilometers on that car in the mountains.
Yeah, just everywhere, man. It was, you know, we covered a lot of ground. We went to every region.
I'm impressed. A few years after, in 2003, I did an internship at Gambrel Rosso. Mm-hmm. I had to like contact the winners of the Trey Bicari Award.
Oh, really?
And I thought, even back, like, that wasn't that long ago, but there was multiple winners, multiple producers who, they didn't have computers. They didn't have a fax machine. You had to like fax the local post office. And then a week later, they would go and pick it up.
The amount of paper was just incredible. And then for many, many, many months after returning home, I had this like sort of rainbow of stacks of paper around my desk in our apartment, which drove my wife insane, because it was like I just had – it was just all, I had to ship boxes and boxes of paper stuff home. Now I just go on their website, and like when I'm writing offers for Somm Select, it's all at my fingertips. It's so much easier.
So you'd like take the brochure that they had created?
Yeah, there'd be like they'd give me a brochure, or I mean, they gave me a lot of wine. So I'm like, in, you know, I had Udine tags on my license plate, and I'd be in like Sardinia with this crappy car loaded down with wine and paper and our belongings. And
that's right, because you didn't have a home base.
Yeah,
right?
We got pulled over all the time. I used to get pulled, but in those days, I don't know what it would be like now, but in those days you could just be like, you know, Americano, and they'd be like, all right, see you later, you know, or explain, you know, what you were doing, and they'd be all right. You know, I got a couple tickets though, like not putting your lights on in a gallery, in a tunnel. I forget which else, but yeah, so we did that. It's pretty mind boggling to think about, like, the DOC section of that book. I had a book that I got from, like, it was like the Ministry of Agriculture or one of the big, it might have been the Unione Italiana Vini. It was the publication that described the DOC disciplines. So this is the book that you would use. It's called the Codice. Now it's all online. If you can go to, I believe it's MIPAF, and go online and get all the DOCs downloaded with all the stuff. This was the printed version of that. So there was no online resource for it. It was published every 2 years because it's so tedious and like the laws are constantly changing. So I had the codice, and I literally had to go through physically the codice and kind of pull what I, because I didn't obviously reproduce it verbatim. I didn't put all the different, you know, like they put every town, they map it out. Like, it's like a verbalized mapping of the DOC. So I would just go through and I'd get the grape stuff and the production, all that stuff. And that was just like, unbelievable. You should see that. I still have the codice somewhere. It's like so dog-eared and beat up, and like, you know, because that was how we, that's how we did it. It was so analog compared to now.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And it was really, you know, it was that immersion though, as you know, is invaluable. It's just so invaluable. And that's, you know, when they hired me, Joe and Mario hired me at Babbo, it wasn't, I mean, I look back on it now and I think of like all the folks that are pursuing sommelier certifications, all the people trying to be master sommeliers now. And there weren't any master sommeliers. Well, there were some, but I mean, they were pretty rare birds, you know.
This episode is brought to you by 750.com. 750 is the indispensable resource for the beverage industry. You know, I use it on a daily basis, both for research for my new wine book that I'm working on right now with Megan Krigbaum, and for my role as wine director of Fausto and co-wine director of Lalu. It's something I find indispensable for my daily job. And I also highly recommend checking out some of the 750 daily articles. They're just fantastic articles all about the beverage industry. I could not do my job without it. And so you got back from this trip.
Yeah, I got back in 01. Yep,
you're writing this book.
I had, of course, hoped to be done with the book before I started at Babbo. I was not even close. So for the first 6 months I worked at Babbo, I was like just grinding this book out. I was late turning in the copy. I was working. You know what it's like. You worked in the place. You know what it's like. It was a super intense place to work.
Busy all the time.
Super busy. Tons of wine. At the time, we didn't really have a proper cellar. I mean, I'm sitting in this beautiful little cellar. Whenever I look at a proper wine cellar in a restaurant. I think about what we were working with there, which at the time...
I remember stories of the excavation, right?
Oh my God. Yeah, that was unbelievable. We should get into that. That's a fun one. But when I first started at Babbo, the cellar was on the top floor of the brownstone. So it was a fourth floor cellar. So some stuff was kept in the dining room. Not ideal, but it was part of the atmosphere, right? And then lots of the sort of good stuff was upstairs. So it was like, I'd like a Barolo. Like it was physically like crazy. And plus all that wine had to get up there in the first place. And we sold a lot of wine there. So, you know, you'd show up to work at, you know, whenever we showed up. For me, it was usually pretty early as the wine director, but we had three sommeliers on the team. There was always two of us on the floor, as you know. And the first thing you did was hump a bunch of boxes up the stairs, put stuff away, like to the tune of like 20, 30, 40 cases at a pop. You know, this was not the kind of place that like, it was just like a, you know, one case of Pinot Grigio for, you know, just to kind of, you know, fill your, we were pumping out a lot of wine there. So, and a lot of it was also stored off site. Some of it was at Italian wine merchants across town. So I would go uptown to Italian wine merchants, grab whatever cases we needed from the basement, stack them by the door, get all the Italian wine merchant guys to be there, hail a cab, get the cab to come around the corner, tell him to pop his trunk, and then run those guys, because they would get really, the cab guys would be like, what are you doing? You know, right. And if once we had a couple cases in the trunk, there was nothing you could do about it. So then we'd throw 14, 15 cases in the car and take a cab back to Babbo and bring them in. So it was always like the wine room was on the fourth floor. Then it had to move downstairs and it moved into the original basement, which was a short basement. And we kind of retrofitted. We had all the cooling stuff and all that. We had to retrofit it all for downstairs in this short basement. And then finally, the neighboring building to Babbo on its right side, if you're looking for it, they decided to dig out their basement, which would have added a tremendous amount of value to their property. So them doing that enabled us to properly dig out the Babbo basement, which was an excavation that was like quite a bit of manual excavation. It was pretty much mostly manual because you couldn't get any gear back there. The buildings are cheek by jowl. So there was like this little conveyor that ran between the two buildings that took dirt out. And it was hardcore. Some pretty primordial stuff going on down there, you know. And we never had a vermin situation.
That's incredible.
In the restaurant, like never had one. I'm not saying there might not have been some discoveries downstairs, but never in the dining room or the kitchen. Incredible. Like how that had, I lived 2 years of my, that was by the time we excavated, I was the GM by then. And so I lived through that kind of terror of like, oh my God, what happens if, you know, and just where stuff goes. And it was a lot to hold together.
Was that hard to give up the wine director position
to be GM?
I think
I wanted to like sort of see it through to that conclusion, because I mean the wine director thing, I was still able to work with wine a lot and talk about wine a lot with guests and all that. It was still a big part of my job, but I wanted to try it. I also wanted to make more money, so I was a kind of a converted sommelier as it is. Like there wasn't the kind of sort of accreditation that a lot of people seek now. They hired me to be the sommelier there, I think, mostly because I could tell some stories about Italy and get people pumped up. And that was what I think a lot of the folks that worked with me in the Babbo days remembered about me, is that like telling stories at pre-shift about Italy and about Italian wine and sort of talking about it in a way that I think what I'm good at is not necessarily some of the technical aspects of being a sommelier, but more about reading people, I think I was good at. And sort of reading like how much information do they crave? Like if it's none, then I will give them none. If it's a lot, I'll give them a lot, you know. But also like sort of what does someone want to hear when a sommelier is talking to them tableside? They really don't want to hear tasting notes. They want to hear this wine is grown on the Ionian coast of Calabria. You know, it's like it's, you know, that kind of thing. And sort of some of the travel stuff or some of the cultural stuff. That was what I was really much more interested in and continue to be more interested in. And the travel part of it to me is so critical. Like I find it hilarious that like people, these sommeliers get to go on trips and stuff. It's like, how do you go on trips? I never went on any trips. You know, I had to like work. There was no like, oh yeah, go ahead, take a week off and go to Italy on that trip. I'm like, that never would have happened. You know, I mean, obviously you probably sacrifice getting paid when you do that kind of thing, but and you know maybe I could have been more creative about it and covered my shifts and whatever.
I wanted the Babbo job so badly. I was invited on a trip to Rioja to visit Maria Lopez de Heredia nice. And some other producers, but like I didn't even mention it in the interview. I think you probably got it pretty quickly.
Like, yeah, you're not going anywhere.
You're not going anywhere. Yeah, I
mean, you get 2 weeks vacation. You know, if you're lucky, and yeah, and I mean, it's a different era. I mean, I think that it was all new. I mean, I give those guys a lot of credit for trusting me to do that job.
Had you ever worked in the restaurant industry before?
I did a little bit. I waitered and stuff, but I was not, you know, technically, I mean, yeah, I mean, I did all this research and I wrote about it, but was I qualified for that job? You could argue it either way. If I were trying for it today, would I be? I don't know, you know, with the same level of experience. Who knows? Because I think it's gotten a lot more professionalized. And that's something I sort of saw in real time at Babbo, was like this trying to professionalize the hospitality industry in the US and sort of coming across people who had done that in the sommelier universe. Like the sommelier was like the first domino kind of thing. And then you started seeing more people approach management and service like with that more professional attitude. I think we still struggle with it. I mean, you could tell me, I haven't had a restaurant now for a while, but whether we're making progress in that regard or whether it's all, you know, actors and singers and
I think we are making progress. I think people take it more seriously. I haven't worked in a restaurant with a sommelier since Babbo.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you're it, right?
I mean, either I'm it or we're at a little bit more of a casual place where managers are sommeliers and we do lots of wine training. But you know, I found we still have lots of actors. They're really drawn to the industry, but sometimes they tend to be our best. They're the best. And a lot of I think people who have another passion and realize the restaurant industry is just a great way to support their other passion can be really successful. So it does give you a certain level of flexibility.
Hospitality is about emotional intelligence, right? I mean, and that was something that I think was good for, you know, it was a big career change for me from being a guy who like, you know, sat at a desk and typed stories up and edited stuff and all that to go to that. It was, it's something that, you know, happened, you know, in my 30s. It wasn't like a young, you know, I would have loved it if it happened 5 or 10 years earlier, maybe just to kind of put it in a different perspective or, you know, but it's also like, when I think about, I mean, Babbo was so formative for me in so many ways, just also, I mean, really for me sharing wine with the people that we got to share it with. I mean, that place was a time too, 2001 to 2008 when I was there, that was a time when, you know, now there's a lot of Italian wine literate people and places out there, right? I mean, you've been at the forefront of that too with your places. And now, it was like, I got there in 2001. The world was our oyster. Like we were really kind of trailblazing in a lot of ways. Like I'm sure there were other good Italian wine lists out there, but we were really a sort of a touchstone for a lot of people. You know, obviously Mario Batali was on TV and we started to develop our website and we had a lot of good information on that thing. You know, I mean, there was a lot of education happening there. You know, there was a lot of like cultural and like whatever geographical, all that, like people were learning about Italian. Like that's why people liked working there, not just because they made $400 a night in tips, but because they learned a lot. And that culture, you know, I tried to bring that culture to my own restaurant when I had one in San Francisco. It was called St. Vincent. And all the servers there were all sommeliers. You know, everyone was sort of, that was the idea of it. It was like, we're all sommeliers, you know, we're all, you know, it was really trying to open up wine to everybody and not make it like you had to just talk to that one dude. You know,
I love that about it. It's, you know, when I worked at Babbo, I was 23 and I was a 23-year-old kid in a suit, and we had servers who'd been there, some of them since the beginning, and who actually knew the wine list a lot better than I did, who obviously were much better at their job than I was. And sometimes they'd be like, I want to talk to the guy in the suit. And that's my job. I was there for sure. But I saw that I got a sort of an unearned level of respect from some of our...
Because you're in the suit.
Because you're in the suit.
Well, I think that's been a very positive upshot of the natural wine thing, is that it's democratized wine a little bit. It's not just like a rich white dude thing. It's now, that's been a very positive thing. I would put the orange wine thing on maybe one of the more negative sides in my view, but the positive side is definitely widening the net of people who are allowed to know about wine. Like that was, I remember actually a waiter at Babbo who thought he knew a lot more about wine than he actually did, but said something to me along the lines. Like, I was like, why are you, what are you doing, dude? You know, like he was talking some nonsense. Like he was just passing misinformation along. And I could have just let it slide, but I was like, come on, man, what are you doing? And he's like, well, you're the only one who's allowed to know something about wine. And I'm like, well, it's not, I mean, I was a little bit wounded, you know, I was like, well, no, but I mean, if you're going to tell him something, at least tell him the right information or don't tell it. So yeah, I mean, I think that the sommelier thing is become very much more democratic. I think the master sommelier thing, if you view it in the right spirit of what it really is a totally positive thing that people want this education. I think that there's a tendency because, you know, they got the pin and they got the suits and it's like a little more formal that they sometimes get saddled with this image of being like that gatekeeper, old fashioned taste event kind of dick sommelier, mm-hmm. you know? And they're the ones that are really actually, they just want it so bad. It's like the definition of the word connoisseur, right? You just want to know everything about this thing that you love. It's connoisseur is like that word is not meant to be snob or gatekeeper or any of those things. It's meant to mean someone who just studies the hell out of the topic that they like. So whether you're a music connoisseur or what was that thing? If the sun also rises. They talked about afición. There's a great passage about bullfighting, which is not something I have afición for, but they talked about that word too, afición, and like sort of defining the word. And I always remember that relative to wine, because that's the thing that I always tried to communicate to people was like, I just really like this a lot and I want to share it with you. Not, oh no, you don't want that wine. Like it's always like, how do you get a good wine in a restaurant? Well, conceivably they're all good, right? Like why would they be on the list if they're not good? I mean, we know that obviously there are many instances when
your boss makes the
yeah,
wines.
Or they're, yeah. I wasn't going to
say.
No,
those wines are great.
Yeah, no, but or that it's a payola deal. I mean, we all know now. I mean, one of the disturbing trends in the restaurant business that I'm seeing, there are a lot of reasons why my restaurant closed, but one of them is that I just didn't charge enough for wine. Mm-hmm. I think we've now, I mean, I don't know where you're at with your markups here, but your financial reality is such that you have to charge high markups. And if anything, I feel like the public has come to accept it a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, I remember Michael Bauer used to send the old critic of the Chronicle used to send the wine lists of restaurants to like somebody that he knew that really knew the pricing. You know, I guess it was somebody who worked in a distributor maybe, or, you know, knew like we know the prices of stuff wholesale and was sort of calculating markups based on that and would really take people to task if their markups were too high. But nobody's going to do that now because I think everyone understands that like you can't have with all the other things that you're trying to do as a restaurant, as an employer, there's just no other way. And that sucks actually because it either diminishes the quality of the wine list or it just turns wine. Like I used to think of it, like I remember talking to the late great Jean-Luc Ledoux about markups because I'd be like talking because we actually tried to really toe the line on that at Babbo. We had really, really great pricing at Babbo, you know, and it wasn't three times across the board. It was very feel driven. It was very like, okay, well, this is, you know, 200 wholesale. I'm not going to just charge 600 for it. And I forget where we were. It might've been Enoteca, actually. I was talking with Jean-Luc Ledoux about it, who was a classic dude. He's like, if someone's going to pay 200 for it, they'll pay 600 for it. You know, it's like, it's just not even a question. You know, it was not even a question to mark up a wine three times. Now, I mean, I'm seeing it. I saw it last night, not naming names, but I saw it last night. I'm like, this is a really expensive list because you can't survive otherwise. Like,
I think
if you're going to make a commitment to wine, I'm saying like you can do other things as a restaurant and not commit to wine, but it's a drag because it makes it hard. You can tell me what it's like because you're still a restaurateur. I'm not anymore. But I think that's it really hurts the category because people want to try stuff, but it's just like, you know, before you know it, you spent. I mean, like last night before I knew it, I spent $250 on wine. I don't make that kind of money. You know, it was just two bottles of wine. You know, it's like that was kind of like a. I mean, maybe I'm out of touch. Like what stuff costs. I went to another restaurant in New York recently, a very acclaimed natural wine outpost. Again, not naming names, but I drank a Sicilian white skin contact. I'm open-minded. I always try them, you know, served in like this little like no stem kind of glass, like not a jelly jar, but like a water glass, basically, like a stemmed water glass. I guess it's sort of trying to sort of extend some sort of like sort of proletarian vibe. I don't know. So, and it just the wine was disappointing. I'll say it was like kind of just flat and oxidized and whatever in this like crappy glass, and it cost $20 for the glass. I'm just like, good Lord, man, what is happening? You know, and maybe I just don't get it. Like I'll always criticize myself first. It's always been my problem in life, is that I'll always be my own worst critic. So I'm like, well, maybe what am I missing here? But everything about that was just so wrong, man. I was just like, what is going on? And I just think the reality of that restaurant, probably what they pay in rent, all the other financial pressures that they're under, there's this profit center that is the wine program, that it's just a drag, you know, that you have to treat it like that.
I agree. And I think that a lot of reason that's happening is food in restaurants is artificially low. The cost, mm-hmm. the pricing of food should be higher.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the dining public can't accept $38 chicken. Yeah, if you're working with a good local farm.
Or $150 Dover sole.
Or $150 Dover sole. I mean, unless you're
I saw on the menu last night. I was like, I'm getting old, man.
Unless you're at like the grill or the pool where people just go there to give their money away.
But it's true. And it's like food. I mean, we have a place in San Francisco called Angler that is punishingly expensive, but they make a pretty compelling argument that it needs to be, you know, they're sort of starting that conversation. I'm sure. I mean, I feel like it's been started in the media too. I mean, mm-hmm. about food prices being artificially low. I think you make a good point there. It's like people won't accept it, even at like a $50 steak, you know? Yeah. And in a way, especially when you think about our crippling beef habit, like maybe it should be prohibitively priced so that people eat less of it. You know, I just think wine is not like exploration is suffering because of where you sort of are compelled to price wines on your list. And, you know, it's one of the things that with Somm Select, we're basically trying to provide this sommelier type experience for you in the form of an email, you know, where it's like, what might I say to someone when I'm selling them this wine tableside? Let's try to translate that into an email, you know, and that's really the main premise behind it. I mean, obviously the site started out as this guy's a master sommelier, and if he says it's good, it's good. And that's still to some extent probably why a lot of people subscribe. I mean, Ian Cauble is the founder of the company and a master sommelier and a really, really good taster. And what I've tried to bring to the table is this like sort of broader perspective of sort of trying to talk to more the masses as opposed to the wine knowledgeable, but also to sort of just bring a new voice to it. And as we've realized, like when I brought my voice to it and started putting offers out under my name, then we need to continue to widen the net. And we're looking to do that. We have other folks that contribute, like Chris Miller, who's a master sommelier. They're not all masters necessarily. And ideally they're people that can write. So if you ever want to write an offer, let me know. You know, if you want to throw your name out there on Somm Select as an endorser, you know, you need to be comfortable with the wine, whatever it is, you know,
I'm honored. That's critical. I'm a subscriber.
Oh, well, thank you. We'd love to have you, man. Italian wine's been my bailiwick, but I'll throw one your way. You can sell an orange wine. You want to say, if you'll do a way better job than me.
What's your beef with orange wine? You started your Italy tour in Friuli. I'm sure you.
I don't have a beef with it. I mean, I got like very famously called out actually when I had St. Vincent. This guy, Hardy Wallace, who I'm now good buddies with, by the way, we had like a little beef. Hardy is the dirty and rowdy winemaker, and he's very, very articulate and really clever with social media and his blog and this, that, and the other thing. And so Richard Betts, the master sommelier and international man of intrigue, wrote an article with the headline, "Why Tecate is Better Than Orange Wine." He quoted both Bobby Stuckey and I in the article. Kind of dogging a lot of orange wines.
Is that called trolling? I think
it's there. Well, it was like a troll article. Yeah, I guess you could call it that. It was a pretty hot take on orange wine, and you know, Bobby and myself, I would say, you know, in terms of Friulian white wines, I came up in the era of Friulian, like sort of steel fermented, super fresh, probably pretty well sulfured white wines that were all about fragrance and aromatics and acidity, not really much in the way of oak. And since then, have you know, obviously particularly at Somme Select, developed a real love affair with white Burgundy, because how can you not? You know, in fact, for me, white Burgundy is more interesting than red Burgundy. It's just really, really unique white wine and that freshness, that energy. And so my beef with a lot of orange wines, not all orange wines, but a lot of orange wines, is that I feel like they lose all the sort of fresh high notes that make white wine special and tend to taste very flat, tend to a lot of times taste very same tasting, as if like sort of the same thing has happened to them in becoming orange, regardless of grape variety. I've been proved wrong many times, but I've also been deeply disappointed in some like very, very famous ones, like including recently with the big guy himself, you know, the master. I mean, like Radicon Sun, for example, those wines are really cool. I like them better than Radicons, but I also remember visiting Radicon in 2000 and tasting out of tank some Ribolla. It was out of a steel tank, mm-hmm. Ribolla, and it was freaking slamming. It was like drinking a great Premier Cru Grand Cru Chablis, like super, super ripping acidity, fresh, mineral, all that. And that's, to me, I get why people make Ribolla orange, but I also don't get it because the appeal of that grape is nerve. There's a lot of acidity in Ribolla. There's great fruit, but it's not like, it's like more in that semi-aromatic category, right? Like Chardonnay is, like Pinot Blanc. And I found that instead they were making wines that kind of tasted tannic, or not even the kombucha knock, you know, some of those knocks. But I've been proved wrong many, many times. I mean,
I wonder if
Skerrick and the Carso, love those wines.
Sandy Skerrick's great.
Who else? I mean, some Amovia's orange whites I've liked, some more than others. Who else? I mean, I'm sure you could pour, I bet you could pour me, you could probably straighten me out on a couple of things. You know, I'm not in the trenches like you anymore.
The demand for them is wild.
Yeah.
Like in Brooklyn right now, at least.
And I get the gastronomic appeal. And I think a lot of times if you take them out of context and don't put them in the context of like what you're eating something, especially like, I know that there are sensations that I'm missing out on by kind of not really gravitating to them, but for me, it's the aromatic range that I feel gets very muted in that practice.
That's it for this episode of In the Drink. I want to thank a few people who are very special and made this episode happen, especially our extremely talented producer, Jessamine Molly. I also want to thank Justin Wright for our ad music and Renny Lopez for our intro music. Big thanks to our sponsor, 750.com. You can find me on Instagram at Joe Campanelli, or if you have any questions, thoughts, suggestions, you can always shoot me an email at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. We'll be back next week for the second half of my interview with David Lynch.